in connection with Warren Schlinger's oral history, made on the 1st of March 2003 by Warren Schlinger and Arnold Thackeray. Warren, please say a little more about your father's career and the growth of what became United Parcel.
Well, as I think I had written in the statement here, he got involved with United Parcel because they bought a delivery business that he was part owner of when they moved to Los Angeles, and this was probably around 1920 or 21, because he was working for United Parcel and my mother and he were married in 1921. And they eventually expanded locally in Southern California. They moved to Long Beach, they moved to Pasadena, they had stations in other parts of Southern California, and eventually down in San Diego. But it wasn't until sometime after 1930, I guess. I really don't know. United Parcel had real problems during the Depression, I do know that. And there's quite a history there, but it's available, but they almost went broke, and it was sold, and then they bought it back, and it was just barely survived during the Depression. But then they elected to move to New York and expand to New York. I'm not sure what the dates were. It was still during the Depression, though, I'm sure.
What was your father's role by the time he retired? What sort of title and function did he have?
Well, he was vice president in charge of the West Coast.
So that's, and by the time he retired, that was no small thing.
No, it was. It was not yet a nationwide business. They had a lot of problems with the Public Utilities Commission and getting permission to ship to any state in the country and any place in the country. It was very long process of doing that, but they had offices in Chicago and they had offices in Cincinnati and they had offices in Atlanta, and they could go back and forth from these offices, but they just couldn't get permission to cover the whole country. That did not happen until after he retired. And when they got that, of course, then they expanded very rapidly.
I take it you didn't hear too much conversation at home about the virtues of government services and the post office.
Well, of course, they were always up against Parcel Post, and it was one of their main competitors. We didn't talk too much about business at home. They had a lot of problems with the unions. I can remember times when he was just completely beside himself trying to get along with the union problems and the pickets and things that they would have. There was a type of company that everybody did everything, and up until World War II, my father was out delivering packages on Christmas Eve. They would promise to deliver anything that was bought before noon on the day before Christmas. And he would, I can remember when he had to go Christmas Day and deliver some things he didn't get delivered on Christmas Eve. But that was the kind of a company they were in. Their aim was to please.
Did he encourage you ever to go into that territory?
No, he did not. And he had one of his brothers work for him at Barcelona there back in the 30s. He never encouraged my brother nor me to join the business. And it never occurred to us to do it. As we say later on, I mean, he very much wanted us both to go to college. And pursue whatever we wanted to pursue.
Deliver things on Christmas Eve.
You know what I mean? He didn't encourage either one of us to go to business school, and neither one of us did.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Good.
I don't know much more than that. I mean, till my first year as a PhD.
Yes, because the master's was mainly coursework.
I had the master's first. But I did work the graveyard shift in the lab on the PVT work and things.
Which was partly a matter of keeping body and soul together.
Well, that was right. And I think at that time I was still working for Swift in his lab for the little lab, but I it's just kind of I don't know when some of these things started and the other one stopped.
But of these sorts of courses in the catalog, you would have then taken as
well
to the masters.
Yeah, we took all the courses that are listed. I mean, you didn't have any choice.
Okay, all right.
I don't think. So. Maybe we had one elective, which if we did, it was in applied math.
Mm-hmm. So it really was a master's by coursework.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, we didn't have a major thesis. But I remember I had to write something. In fact, that's what Katie typed up for me.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
We got us going.
Do you still have that somewhere?
I don't know. I think I still have a copy of my PhD thesis.
Yes. Yes.
All the pictures are falling off because they were put in with rubber cement.
Well, it's the master's thesis where the trouble began.
Well, we didn't really have a thesis, a master's mm-hmm. thesis, but I remember writing the paper, and I don't remember what it was. I don't know I can't remember where my work began, what I was getting paid to do, and what I was doing for research. I mean, they were all kind of
interwoven.
Everything was all hooked together.
Yes. Yes. Warren, there's another subject we should talk about. You say around page 40. On page 43, you say your thesis was composed of three different things, and you talk about normal, pentene, and butene, and then you say, then I had the thermodynamic properties of NO2. Can you talk about that piece of your dissertation work?
Well, let me think about it a second here before we get started. A hired fellow to work with me.
Why were you doing the thermodynamic properties of NO2? What was the point of that?
Okay.
NO2 had been proposed for a oxidant in liquid propelled rockets, and I guess it's still used even today. We were funded by the Office of Naval Research to develop the thermodynamic properties of NO2 to aid in design of the propellant systems. After thinking about various things and realizing we had to deal with a very corrosive substance, we decided to build a constant volume spherical bomb with capability of measuring temperatures and pressures as we heated the material up and it became vaporized, and we had two phases which we could further study. The bomb was then immersed in a bath of silicones, which were a brand new substance at that time. Dow had just developed the commercial production of silicones. And this bomb was inserted into the fluid bath, which was carefully temperature, the bath was carefully controlled. And as we changed the temperature of the silicone, of course the pressure would go up or down in the bomb, and we would carefully evaluate that, and then we'd remove part of the NO2 from the container and repeat the operations. So we basically developed a system that was changing in equilibrium because of the polymerization action of NO2 and 2O4 in the gas phase. Didn't behave like a normal compressible fluid. As pressure went up, it got denser much faster than the pressure by itself would indicate it. Anyway, that was the third part of my thesis, but it did require a lot of construction assembly because we had to start from scratch to put the equipment together and had to provide a few safety features because of the corrosive nature of the gas and the fact that it was not very good to inhale it.
You actually built the bomb.
Machine did.
Yeah.
I had a help with machines.
Yes.
The machine shop helped me build the bomb, although I had to do the design work on it. But we had some good machinists. Mm-hmm. They took it as a challenge to make a sphere on a lathe. That's a good, takes a little bit of experience. Yes.
Make it out of what? Stainless steel?
We made it out of 310 stainless steel. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That was an incredibly difficult and complex subject area, wasn't it, to be trying to investigate?
Well, no, I don't believe the thermodynamic properties of NO2 itself was terribly unusual. It was just complicated by the fact that the molecule polymerized very easily, and then the polymerization was function not only of temperature but also pressure. So some of the, when you plot up the PVT property or the PVT pressure versus temperature diagram with lines of constant the gas looked like it ended up with a compressibility factor of of a half instead of one as the pressure was decreased to zero. It looked unusual.
What was most difficult there? Was it designing the apparatus or making it work?
Well, if you didn't design it right, of course it wouldn't work. But we didn't have too many problems making it work. But we did have quite a few problems assembling it and getting proper seals on the. It was actually, the bomb was in two halves, and two hemispheres, and we could that screwed together with a Bridgman seal, and we had trouble making it work. I think we finally had to use a gold gasket, as I recall. We tried because copper would be was not, and lead were not not inert to attack by the NO2. So as I recall, we had a small gold gasket. I forgot about that, right?
But doing these things did make you feel you wanted to be a chemical engineer.
Well, as I said early in the game, chemical engineering at Talcott was different than chemical engineering at most other schools.
Yes.
Because of this emphasis on knowing how to build things and figuring out how to build things. That equipment was used for a number of other compounds many years after I left.
Now we're on page 82 and what page is that? 88. We're on page 88 and we're talking about the we're talking about the cool water plant, and you've just said the whole thing was designed for a 6-year demo program. So what actually happened?
The cool water plant ran for its 6 years quite successfully. Several changes in the configuration were developed during that time. But it met all the emission standards required by the state of California by better than a factor of 10, and certainly proved that the technology was viable. Unfortunately, the cost still was a major problem, and the plant was shut down at the end of the demo period. Edison did not feel that they wanted to acquire it, because they could have picked it up for a song, and it was eventually dismantled and moved to a chemical company in Kansas, where, as far as I know, it's operating today. But the test provided a large amount of valuable design data for future combined cycle coal gasification plants. Such a plant has already been built in China, and we may have more even in this country. That's good.
That depends crucially on the price of oil.
It's all a matter of cost of power.
But if oil price goes up, this is one immediately available route from coal.
Well, that's right. As I think I mentioned a little later on, I have been promoting, even in my retirement, the building of combined cycle coal gasification plant that is used to inject CO2 into old oil formations and to recover additional oil. But that's a... There's just no small way to begin something like this. You got to put together a
billion-dollar power plant before you can prove what you're doing.
Well, you remained engaged with the operation of Cool Water in some way.
Oh, yeah, through
that whole period.
Yeah, I made frequent trips to Cool Water and participated in meetings. You know. Mm-hmm.
So, once again, you're a little before your time, is what you're telling me.
I guess that's the name of the game.
Yes. It's a wonderful and a frustrating game, I guess.
Right, right.
Okay. So, the one other area we might talk about is turbulent flow hydrogenation, which preceded Tex fining.
Yeah.
And
I think when it came into being, let me see. How we got started on that, try to. I went down to a 356. I went down to a annual research and technical division review meeting in Florida, and I had some results then. I wonder if it's worth including in there, because
in the text, because that's the easiest thing to work out later. But let's
talk about what leads up to.
Do you recall what that was?
Following our development of the hydrotreating process for pre-treating feeds going to the platformer in the refineries, we started working on a technology we call turbulent flow hydrogenation. And this was based on the fact that there was seemingly a surplus of naphtha in the world, and this was a very easily transportable fuel by ship, whereas surpluses of natural gas couldn't be moved very effectively. And we found by treating naphtha with high pressure hydrogen, the pressure is up in the order of 200, 300 atmospheres. Heating the naphtha and cracking it in the presence of a high partial pressure of hydrogen, we could make substantial conversion of the material to ethylene and propane as well as methane. And the thought was that this could be used as a source of energy for a synthetic gaseous fuel that could be distributed in townships that were now dependent upon gas from coal, as well as taking advantage of the fact that we were making ethylene and propylene, which were basic chemicals of interest to the petrochemical business. We did this by running hydrogen in the naphtha feed through high velocity and high pressure tubing in a coiled heater. We made some interesting yield structures, but we never found a good commercial spot for it. And later this same concept was applied to feeding residual oil containing high ash contents and high condensed rain components, which we found we did get a good conversion out of it, but we couldn't prevent coking in the heater when we got the temperature up high enough to get an optimum yield of product. And this version of the turbine flow hydrogenation then was continued when we went to the developing the TEX spining process, which followed a few years later. I think that's
good. Good, we'll work that in. Excellent.